الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله
series on Islamic beliefs and Islamic teachings. And our guest today is Dr. Jamal Badawi from St. Mary's University, and he will cover the second part on the concept of God, capital G, in Islam. Assalamu alaikum, Dr. Jamal, and welcome to our program. I was wondering if we could start by recapping very quickly or introducing our subject by giving the main points of our last program as they link to today's issues.
There were basically two main issues that we discussed last time. One dealt with the basic sources of knowledge about God or about beliefs in general, and the second was the Islamic term for God, capital G. The first issue was the one that we spent most of the time on, and basically we said according to Islam there are three basic sources of knowledge: fitra, or the innate pure nature, the use of human faculties, and revelation. Mm-hmm. On the question of fitra in Arabic, which, like I said, roughly means the pure, universal, natural disposition of the human, we said that basically this is a kind of built-in spirituality that is inherent with the creation of the human, that a person has this basic nature of recognizing the presence of God, of having the basic distinction between good and evil, and also of the feeling to turn to God at the time of need, distress, or danger. Secondly, we discussed the use of human faculties as source of knowledge, which includes both sensory as well as intellectual. And we have given various examples from the Quran that shows that in Islam, there is no contradiction really between faith and reason. That in fact, reason and the use of intellect could be a very strong tool to strengthen and inculcate faith in the human being. And then we discuss various quotations from the Quran on various levels, where the Quran implores the human to look into themselves, like the functioning of the human body, looking into the environment and see the delicate ecological balance. Mm-hmm. And looking into the entire universe also and its creation. And we said that this kind of coordinated and balanced scheme of creation, according to Islam, is the most profound evidence of the existence of God and the most obvious manifestation of his divine attributes. Mm-hmm. We added, however, that these two sources of knowledge in themselves may not be sufficient without divine guidance, because our pure an innate natural disposition might be clouded because of personal weakness, social pressures, or other historical forces. And so also our human faculties and reason are at times limited. They are not absolute. They are not perfect. And at times they are myopic. So we said finally that humanity needs divine revelation. This would be very important to resolve issues that a human being can never settle, like what is ethical and moral. It would help also acquire the type or category of knowledge which could never be obtained by the use of conventional scientific methods, and these are things like the knowledge of the unseen, knowledge about the attributes of God, about the purpose of creation, about the nature of life after death. And finally, in the second issue, we were discussing the basic term used in Islam about to express God, capital G. And he said that the Arabic term is Allah, A-L-L-A-H. And he said that this simply means the one and only universal God of humanity, of all. Mm-hmm. Trying to emphasize that we're not really talking about two different things when we say Allah or God, capital G. and we indicated even that the term Allah is even more accurate as compared to the English term, because the English term God is subject to S, to the plurality. You can say gods. It is subject to female gender when you say goddess, whereas the term Allah in Arabic does not have any plural or any male or female gender. This was basically the main 2 points.
Well, if we take off from that point, am I correct in understanding that the Muslims, when they refer to God as Allah, are referring to the same deity as the Christians and Jews, for instance?
Fundamentally, yes. Just like when a Frenchman says Dieu, which is the French equivalent of, of God. I have never seen anyone who says that when the Frenchman says Dieu, he's talking about the God of the French people. Yeah. This is a very simple and logical rule. However, oftentimes this rule is violated when writers who are not Muslims write about Islam, which is the most common literature in this country. Mm-hmm. And they leave the readers with the distinct impression that Allah is some kind of the God of the Muslims.
Yeah.
Indeed, this false impression still persists until today, the kind of stereotype. The other day I was addressing high school students in Queen Elizabeth High School,
mm-hmm.
and I kept explaining what is the word Allah means, and we talk about the same basic monotheistic concept of deity. And after I finished, one student asked me, and he addressed me in his question. He said, your God. I said, brother, we're not talking, let's not talk about my God and your God. Let's talk about our God, the God of the entire humanity. So that shows, again, how persistent this kind of misconception even until today.
Well, that may raise an even more interesting point of what do the Christians and Jews living in the Arab world, in our terms, for whom Arabic is the mother tongue, mm-hmm. what term do they use?
Well, you'd be surprised. Mm-hmm. Exactly the same term as Muslims do. Mm-hmm. Allah. Because simply that's the Arabic term for God, capital G. If you go, for example, to Lebanon, which is nearly half Muslim, half Christian, mm-hmm. more or less,
mm-hmm.
you cannot distinguish. If you hear people talking, you say Allah, a Christian would be saying Allah, the Muslim would be saying Allah, and they mean basically the same thing. Of course, it is quite possible to make sure that a Jew, a Christian, and Muslim may have some differences about a specific interpretation or definition of divine attributes. They may have differences in accepting or rejecting certain types of doctrines, like, for example, the idea of chosen people, the idea of Trinity.
Mm-hmm.
There may be differences on such kind of doctrines, but on the whole, on a fundamental level, they're really talking about the basic thing. They're talking about the one and only transcendent, all-powerful, all-merciful creator, provider of the universe. So in reality, the concepts are Basically the same.
Now, how can we reconcile ourselves with all the writers, let's say, on Islamic studies that claim that Allah is not an Islamic term and that Allah existed as a name of a deity in the Arabian Peninsula years and years before Islam appeared on the form?
Okay, I have already explained that what in Arabic, the Arabic language, the word Allah means is the one and only creator or God. Now, if any term has been perverted or used in a mistaken or erroneous way, that does not change the reality of it. In fact, the name must be restored back to its original use. This is one thing. The other thing which is even more interesting is that there is a common error also, or common mistaken assumption behind the statements similar to this. That is that the Arab, the pre-Islamic Arab, that's where Islam started first in its final form, they knew nothing about monotheism, that all they knew was idol worship, which is a very, very common error, very erroneous. Because monotheism was known to the Arabs. Indeed, it was introduced centuries ago by Prophet Abraham and his son Ishmael. As you know, Prophet Abraham took his son Ishmael to Arabia, and this that's why Prophet Ishmael is regarded as like the grandfather of the Arabs, or the Arabs in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with this type of understanding, we can say that the Arabs did have some notion and understanding of monotheism. Possibly at one time or the other, they used the term Allah in the proper sense, the Lord of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they perverted their practice and forgotten the true teaching of Abraham and Ishmael, like what happened in many nations. A prophet would come, after he goes, people start deviating from his basic teachings and introducing their own ideas into that. This does not necessarily mean that the term Allah really does not refer to what actually it is intended to refer. And then with the advent of Prophet Muhammad, this term was restored back to its originality, or to be more accurate, monotheism was restored back to its original purity, just like the case of the Kaaba, for example, the Holy Kaaba. The Kaaba was built initially by Prophet Abraham as a shrine of monotheism for the worship of the one God. Actually, it is the first house ever to be built on earth as a shrine for monotheism.
Okay.
Now, the fact that pre-Islamic Arabs have perverted the use of Kaaba and put idols inside that does not change its historical origin. And that's why when Muhammad and the Muslims had victory finally, they destroyed the idols, they cleansed the Kaaba and restored it back to its original terms. It's a matter of restoration of monotheism, really.
Right. Okay, having clarified the term Allah and clarified what it means in Islam and as it relates to the word God in English, maybe now we should ask the question, is Islam as a faith expressed in a creedal form? Does it have a profession of faith, like the Shema, for instance, for the Israelites? Does Islam have such a profession of faith?
Yes, it does. It's a very simple but profound. Sometimes people, when you say simple, they think that simple is only for simple people or simple minds. It's simple but very profound. It says in Arabic, أَشْهَدُ أَنْ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا اللَّهِ وَأَشْهَدُ أَنَّ مُحَمَّدًا رَسُولُ اللَّهِ, which means in English, I bear witness that there is no deity or no God but Allah, which we said, capital G, God. There is no deity but Allah, and that Muhammad is his messenger. Now, as you notice, you can say that this creedal form or confession of faith is composed of basically two points, which reflect two very important beliefs for the Muslim. The first part, I bear witness that there is no deity but Allah, is a reference to the concept of pure monotheism, the oneness and uniqueness, or unique oneness of Allah. That's the first part. The second part, and I bear witness that Muhammad is his messenger, is actually a reflection of another concept that perhaps we'll be coming back to in another series, the concept of prophethood in Islam. You might wonder why I say prophethood, not just the belief in Muhammad, but the answer to that, as will be clarified later, is that once a person believes in Muhammad, who is the last of all messengers, by definition, one has to believe also in all the previous prophets, the succession of prophets, Muhammad only being the last one of them. Now, the mere recitation with conviction, that's the point, with conviction, under no compulsion, if the person recites this, according to Muslim jurists, this would suffice to enter him into the folds of Islam.
Yeah.
In other words, there is no need for officiation, no church, quote-unquote, structure or hierarchy. He might say that in front of anyone, but actually, to say that with conviction suffice to enter the person into the folds of Islam. It's a matter of not ceremonies, but rather sincerity and deep understanding and conviction of what it means.
Yeah. It's very interesting to note in the Shahada or in the creedal formula of Islam that it starts with a negation. In other terms, it doesn't say there is one God, but it says, I bear witness that there is no God but one God, and Allah is his name. Now, is there any significance to that initial negation?
Yes, there is. In fact, it's very essential. I give at least three basic reasons for that.
Mm-hmm.
First, by definition, when a person admits the supremacy and the oneness or unique oneness of Allah, then it follows also that one must reject any other deity than Allah. In other words, it would be a contradiction of terms simply to say there is God, but somehow implying that there could be also other gods.
Of course.
the pure monotheism means the rejection also of any other false deity and the negation of any godhood attributed to any of the creatures of Allah.
Yes.
A second main reason is that even though pure monotheism, the belief in the one God, has been preached by all prophets throughout history according to the Quran,
mm-hmm.
as I said before, still the concept has been perverted and changed. People added their own ideas and philosophies, which resulted in fact in a sort of paganizing or changing the purity of the nature of monotheism.
Mm-hmm.
So it was necessary and very important also to clarify the right from the wrong and which deviations are not really authentic and relevant to the pure teaching of the prophets from Adam to Muhammad. The third reason is that Islam being the Islam in the final form, because it said all prophets preached Islam, but the mission of Prophet Muhammad being the conclusion of this prophetic tradition which extends throughout history, it's very essential to clarify the errors that has taken place prior to the mission of Prophet Muhammad, so that it warns people, it brings to the attention of believers what kind of temptations and erroneous interpretations of God has taken place, so as to avoid them and maintain the purity in the future, the purity of the faith and the purity of monotheism.
Mm-hmm. I suppose since it's a very wealthy and rich concept, we should start by looking at the negations and then move maybe in the next program to the affirmative side of the creedal formula in Islam. And to start the negations, maybe we should, although you mentioned that before, but could you elaborate a little bit on the position of Islam vis-a-vis the idol worshipping that was rampant in the Arabian Peninsula before its appearance?
In fact, the idol worship was not only rampant among the pre-Islamic Arabs, but if you study history also, you find that it was rampant as well in so many nations in the past. I wonder even whether it might be persisting even until today in some places in the world. The Quran indicates, for example, just to give an evidence of this, documented evidence, the Quran talks about the dialogue between Prophet Abraham and his father. And I quote from the Quran, chapters 19, verse 42, and mention in the book the story of Abraham. He was a man of truth, a prophet. Behold, he said to his father, O my father, why worship that which hears not, and sees not, and can profit you nothing? There's something even that's quite touching in the Quran when it talks about the story of Prophet Abraham with his people, in his dialogue with them to bring the point or drive the point home. The story, just to make it brief, and then I just quote from the Quran the verse that deals particularly with this issue.
Mm-hmm.
It says that the people went out of the town for one of their festivals, the people of Abraham, and he refused to go with them. He stayed behind.
Mm-hmm.
And when everybody went out, he went inside the temple where they used to have their idols. He took an axe, and he smashed them to pieces. He only spared one idol, which was the biggest mm-hmm. of the idols.
Mm-hmm.
And some interpreters of the Quran say also that he might have put the axe in the hands of the big idol.
Mm-hmm.
When the people returned back from their picnic or whatever festival, they went back mm-hmm. to town, they entered into the temple, mm-hmm. and they were outraged and very angry to find that their gods are all smashed into pieces. Mm-hmm. They suspected that it was probably Prophet Abraham, because he was the one who's talking about monotheism, about rejection of idol worship.
Mm-hmm.
They brought him for questioning, and like the verse says, they told him, "Are you the one that did this to our gods, O Abraham?" He said, "Nay, their biggest idol did it. Ask them if they can speak intelligently." So, in other words, he's bringing home in a very logical way the point that, okay, these are so many gods, and there is a big god there, a big idol. Maybe those gods got into some quarrel, and that big fellow, using his muscles, he smash them. Mm-hmm. Nobody could smash him. Mm-hmm. And all right, if you don't believe me, you want to ask him, ask them. Where basically he's saying that this object which cannot hear, cannot listen, cannot defend itself against destruction. Exactly, yeah. Are totally incapable of even defending themselves.
Mm-hmm.
The Arabs before Islam had their share of this kind of perversion, like many other nations also. In fact, there were so many gods, in a sense of idols, worshipped by the pre-Islamic Arabs, that sometimes you have a tribal god, a god for one particular tribe.
Mm-hmm.
When they travel, they used even to carry some of their gods with them. So imagine a god being carried in your pocket the or in your camel, mm-hmm. in a caravan, which was so ridiculous. What was even more funny is that some Arabs used to get some of those dry dates. Remember, like mm-hmm. this famous California dates?
Yeah.
And then they press it to make it in a form of a statue, and that becomes an idol to be worshipped. Mm-hmm. And then after they get hungry, when they really run short of food, they eat it.
They eat
mm-hmm. their god in that sense.
Mm.
So this was a kind of ridiculous stuff. Actually, they used also to go at the feet of their idols and sacrifice animals, thinking that they are gaining favor with God or something, or intercession. So what happened really is that with the advent of Islam, like I mentioned before, all of these forms were totally annihilated and monotheism was restored back.
Mm-hmm. Maybe at this point you could clarify to us a question that lurks in a lot of people's minds, and that is, what would make human beings stoop so low as to worship a piece of stone or a statue or an inanimate object?
It is very rare that you really find someone who would, in his heart or her heart, really believe that this is their God, even in this past periods. Because I said what they behaved is really was very funny and ridiculous, and I think they were the first one even to know that this is not necessarily true.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other reasons also behind this kind of perversion. For example, historically, at times when some people died, a pious man died, for example, some people might make a kind of shrine or a statue just to, in memory of that dead person.
Mm-hmm.
And as Ibn Abbas, one of the companions of the Prophet, explains, as quoted in Bukhari, he said that gradually people would forget the origin of the idol or the statue and actually turn it actually into an object of worship.
Mm-hmm.
This was probably one of the reasons. The other thing also is that many people, idol worshippers, did not really believe that those idols are gods in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, they used them more or less as intermediaries or intercessors between God and man. So they thought that by appeasing those idols, by worshipping them, by sacrificing animals at their feet or whatever, that they are gaining favor with God. But the third reason seemed to be perhaps more common, because it applies even to other than idol worshippers. And that is the human weakness and tendency to try and materialize everything in a tangible and physical type of form,
right,
which is a human type of inclination, you know, because that's how our perceptions work. So we try to put
an insecurity would be abstract. You like
exactly.
to feel.
To have something touchable. Yeah. You don't want just to think of something that's great or transcendent. It's very hard, especially with the early stages of human development. The higher concepts might be difficult to accept. Touchable things might be more closer to people's mind. So with this kind of attitude, people started searching for God. And in that search, they tried to have some kind of image for God so that they can identify or relate to.
Yeah.
Which, like I said, is a natural human weakness or something, but still doesn't necessarily mean that it's correct, because you can put higher concepts all in physical title, touchable images.
Well, as long as we are on this particular point, why don't we extend the discussion to the worship of natural phenomena or forces of nature, like the sun, the moon, the wind. This was, again, very common in mythology as well as pre-Islamic Arabia.
Particularly sun worship.
That's right, particularly sun worship in Persia, let's say. Again, what would make people move in that direction?
Right. Again, this is another example or another facet of man's error while he's searching for truth. The motive for searching for truth is good and commendable, but again, there are errors on the way, and that's why you mentioned earlier that you need divine revelation, right, to guide that search in the proper way. But in that search for the power behind the universe, the creator, the merciful provider of the universe, people get so fascinated with powers of nature, the powers that they feel can benefit them, or the powers that are capable of doing any harm to them.
Mm-hmm.
About heavenly bodies or stars, again, people used to have lots of superstitions because they're too remote, about their impact in determining the destiny of the human being. Like astrology, for example, is a reflection, again, of this kind of thinking. With this kind of thinking, people gradually might turn in, instead of just adoring this or admiring these forces of nature, into actually worshipping those forces or try to appease them or seek benefits from them. As far as the Islamic position from this, it is totally rejected, and in fact, it indicates in the Quran that these are only creatures of Allah, not substitute or have parallel power with Allah. Maybe I can quote two citations from the Quran that drives the point home.
Mm-hmm.
In one verse in chapter 41, that's verse 37, it says, among his signs, that's the signs of God's existence and power, among his signs are the night and the day, the sun and the moon. Adore not the sun and the moon, but adore or prostrate to Allah who created them. If it is him you wish to serve. Very simple logic and very powerful clarification that they are creatures. You worship the one who created them. In another moving story, again to quote Prophet Abraham, because again this is a common prophet for all monotheistic faith. It's mentioned in the Quran quite frequently. He was trying to educate his people, and he wanted to give them a practical example where there's involvement in the search for truth. I'll just quote the verses and still tell you the story, because it tells it very clearly and flatly. It says, and that's, by the way, for reference, in chapter 6, verses 74 through 79. It says, "Lo, Abraham said to his father Azar, do you take idols for God? For I see you and your people in manifest error."
Yeah.
"So also did we show Abraham the power and laws in the heavens and earth, that he might have certitude.
Mm-hmm.
When the night covered him over, he saw a star. He said, this is my Lord. But when it set, he said, I love not those who set. When he saw the moon rising in splendor, he said, this is my Lord. But when the moon set, he said, unless my Lord guides me, I shall surely be among those who go astray. When he saw the sun rising in splendor, he said, this is my Lord. This is greater. That's greater than others. Stars. But when the sun set, he said, O my people, I am indeed free from your guilt of associating other deities with Allah. For me, I have set my face firmly and truly towards him who created the heavens and the earth, and never shall I associate other partners with Allah."
I don't think we can close the program with more befitting terms. We hope to continue that subject next time, inshallah. And until we see you, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much, and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
الله أكبر الله أكبر.